This program is an encore presentation of a previously broadcast dialogue program. Today on Dialogue, we're going to take a very personal look at America's very special contribution to the world's musical culture, jazz. And just as jazz is played to be felt and remembered for its very direct impact on us, we're going to look at it through the eyes of one man and his music. And my guest today is Dr. Robert S. Litwack. Bob Litwack, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you here, Bob. And I think everyone's going to be pleased to know that this is not going to be a dry historical lesson about a great art form. It's going to be very lively and very personal. I'm sure of that. You know, one thing that I think listeners are going to be fascinated by, and I'm going to tell them right now, I said Dr. Robert S. Litwack. Let me tell them that you are a cardiothoracic surgeon. And that's interesting in itself, because that is obviously a discipline with its own honorable history and demands and challenges. The question is, how does a cardiothoracic surgeon, who's a superb one at that, get involved in jazz? How did you become a jazz musician?
Well, over the complaints of a schoolteacher mother, having had the privilege of training with a number of magnificent drummers, including one of Glenn Miller's great drummers, when I was in high school, thanks to a split session arrangement, I played at a local jazz joint 7 nights a week, by the way, for $27 a week. And if you took a night off, you had to pay your...
Where was this?
This was out near Mitchell Field, out on Long Island,
right.
A place called San Suzanne that no longer exists. But it gave me the opportunity to play with some fine professional players. And then after that, after a brief stint with a couple of big bands during World War II, I went off to school, and from there on did very little playing until a few years ago when I had the chance to get back into jazz and play with small groups in New York.
Why, Bob, did you choose drums? What made drums the instrument?
Well, that gets back to a literal traumatic incident, apparently. When I was a little fellow, perhaps 2 or 3, my mother had a lovely grand piano that was right next to the radio. Mm-hmm. And I'm told that when I was listening to some music, I apparently went to the kitchen, grabbed a few knives, and with the closed piano covering over the keys, I apparently made rather, as we would say, mincemeat of that cover. And my grandmother, who lived with us, told my mother that she really felt that my chosen instrument would be drums. They went out and bought me a little tin drum, and I started from there. Then I began to, in all seriousness, began to formally study at age 9 and had a magnificent number of superb teachers. Yeah. And that's the way it happened.
What makes, and I know we're going to be listening to Buddy Rich, who is a giant, that goes without me having to verify it, but what makes a great drummer?
Well, first, he has to, needless to say, have certain technical skills, for simply manipulative facility. But above that, a great ear to listen to others. If you don't listen... When you're playing a tune, whether it's jazz or whether you're in a symphony orchestra, you are a component of a group. You are not a soloist under any circumstances. Even when you're soloing, you have to play the solo as it conforms to the melody.
You can't take off on a bat. You've got to be...
Well, you can do anything you want in terms of the solo, for example.
Right.
But... if you're soloing, it ought to reflect the melody. And when you're playing with a big band or even a small group, you have to be a component of that group. Yeah. You, in my view, perhaps it's not one universally held, you really can't stand out as someone who can always be picked out as the drummer. Sometimes some good drummers are described as men and women, I might add, with, quote, big ears, end quote, because that simply means that they are listening. Then, of course, there are all the formal skills of being able to, with a big band, to sight read well, and to phrase with a band. In other words, technique, good taste, And of course, when you're talking jazz, if you ain't got good time, you ain't got nothing.
Forget the other two, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You know what I'd like to do now is, I said earlier, this is not going to be a history lesson. It's not going to be a history lesson, but we are going to deal with eras and schools because I think we've got the right man for the job in Bob Litwack. There is a period that fascinates me because in the 20s and 30s, or perhaps a bit earlier, we get this evolution, that's the word I'll use,
surely,
from ragtime into a big band era. I'd love to talk to you about that because I know that you were very much a part of the big band era. What's first of all, why does this happen and what's distinctive about the, how does the big band era begin in the jazz
Well, music? First a disclaimer. I really feel like I'm just a small component of this. I don't pretend to be an expert unique in this area. But let me simply present my viewpoint.
Certainly.
Out of the small, wonderful black groups, both in the South and Midwest, Chicago, New Orleans, came Kansas City, because without that we wouldn't have the great Count Basie, came a emolument of these small groups. Big bands began to form because there were some excellent arrangers who could put down something that a band collectively could make, if you will, sound, if not better, certainly different than a small group. And classically, one can think of the genius of Count Basie, the genius of a Duke Ellington, as they put these magnificent bands together. Many times these great black bands began a formal arrangement out of what they termed a head arrangement.
Something they just carried in their heads?
Something that evolved from having played a tune a number of times, and simply because they could, if you will, feel each other.
Right.
The sense of communication that was nonverbal, simply a look, a sound.
Yeah.
A head arrangement was born, and out of it, some great big band things evolved. What's interesting, of course, when we think of big band music, on one hand, there's big band jazz, and then there, if I may put it this way, in large measure, this involved black bands initially. Most of the white bands that came along a bit later really were dance bands. For example, Benny Goodman's first band really did not make it because they literally had to play dance music, which included waltzes. And only when they finally recognized they just weren't making it, almost out of desperation, one of the trumpet players in Benny's band simply said, "The heck with it. Let's play some stuff that's up that we like. If we're going to flunk the course, let's flunk it with joy." And so that's the way it happened.
You know, Benny Goodman, who we're going to talk about certainly in a few minutes, is a pioneer in so many ways. And I think of him as the perfect kind of bridge, if you will, between the black band and the white band, and then the mixed band, of course, because he was the person who did that.
Yes,
when no one else or a few others were doing it.
Teddy Wilson, a magnificent black pianist. It was Benny who broke the color line, something that we can be very delighted about.
Absolutely,
because over the years, black and white musicians have played together lovingly, respectfully, and the only thing that the black guys and the white guys wanted of each other was simply, is he good?
Yeah. Would that the world itself were like the world of the jazz musician.
Right.
Let's listen, Bob, to you. I know you've got a Basie that you want us to listen to. What is it?
It's a classic Basie thing called 1 o'clock Jump.
Let's hear it.
Thank you.
What's the era of 1 o'clock jump?
Well, the Basie band late '20s, early '30s, and then it just grew.
Mm-hmm.
I'm told that Basie thought that his whatever it was, 9 or 10 piece band, that little Kansas City group of his, mm-hmm. was the best thing the best band he ever had. But in fact, I think this was just simply an individual point of view, because the Count had it was just a continuous, yeah. great affair with the Count's bands. There simply never was a bad one.
You know, that marvelous way you've got, you make me think of additional questions as you give me great answers. First of all, when I keep using the phrase big band. It just occurred to me, what do we mean by big band? What are we talking about in terms of size?
It's a good point. Most big bands had at least 5 brass, that is 3 trumpets, 2 trombones. This is minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, saxophones, 4, and after a fairly brief period, 5. That is 2 alto saxophones, 2 tenor saxophones, and a baritone saxophone. Rhythm section, at least 3, piano, bass, and drums, and generally a guitar. So we're talking, those are the elements.
Right.
Later on, it grew to bands with 4 and 5 trumpets,
mm-hmm.
3 to 4 trombones, generally 3 or 4 rhythm, and yeah. 5 saxophones.
You know, Bob, another of the great pioneers that you mentioned correctly with this era, and is a monument himself, of course, is Edward Kennedy Ellington, the Duke.
Absolutely, a genius.
I know you wanted to hear something of his, too. What have you chosen?
Well, the Duke, there was no other man like the Duke in the history of jazz, as far as I'm concerned. But, of course, one of the many things that he did was a classic, take the A-Train.
Oh,
anybody
yeah.
who's ever been a New Yorker knows what the A-Train
Absolutely.
Is. Take the A-Train, and mm-hmm. Perhaps you might want to listen to a little of that.
We certainly do want to listen to it. Let me just add before we play it that I've given to understand, I haven't heard this directly from the Royal Palace, but I understand that Queen Elizabeth II of England also cites this as her favorite.
I believe that's true. Yes.
So let's hear it now.
Okay.
I think the word for that is splendid. It brings us also this our discussion on the Duke. It puts me in mind of another figure, another giant we mentioned earlier, that I'd like for us to turn to right now, because I think it's very appropriate that, as we said a few moments ago, Benny Goodman, not just a great musician, but also a great human being. And we've been talking about black bands and how they began this big band area and began jazz itself. But now we come to a figure who's pivotal in ways both social and musical. Tell us a bit about your impression of Benny Goodman first.
Well, I think having had the privilege of knowing Benny personally briefly and the privilege of knowing a lot of musicians who had worked with Benny extensively, certainly he was a complex man. Mm-hmm. We'll accept that. But one thing about that remarkable guy, he broke the color line in jazz. A magnificent pianist, Teddy Wilson, black, was Benny's pianist. And this simply had not ever happened before.
When was this about?
In the early 30s, mid-30s. Mm-hmm. And it is one of the beautiful things about jazz that, as we discussed, I think, a little earlier, as long as you were good, it really doesn't matter what color right. your integument is. Mm-hmm. And Teddy Wilson, I think, was Benny's favorite pianist for so many years.
Having so eloquently introduced Benny Goodman to us, Bob, with this big band era, what have you chosen for us to get an idea of what this was like?
Well, we've touched on the fact that many of the white bands, in fact, most, were dance bands. And it's an interesting thing that Benny's theme, Let's Dance, was adapted from Von Weber's Invitation to the Dance.
The classical piece. Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh. So I think if you'd like, we can play Benny's theme adapted from Von Weber, Let's Dance.
Let's hear it. Kind of moving historically here, Bob, through the 30s and into the 40s, and I guess on everyone's mind, and ours too at this point, has to be kind of an American icon, Glenn Miller.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about the Glenn Miller phenomenon, I guess might be the best word for it, in the big band era.
Well, Miller was a first-rate arranger and a first-rate trombonist. Did a lot of arranging and made a living, primarily with his arranging. Did some studio work. In any event, circumstances were such that he formed a big band and which primarily was a commercial dance band, and frankly the first band just didn't make it for a variety of reasons. And of course I really have to give a nod to one of my dear friends and magnificent big band historian, George Simon, who happily is a personal friend and simply has recorded this era with unique brilliance. Mm-hmm. And so much of what I've learned comes from talking with George and reading his beautiful books on the subject. But in any event, it was the second band where Miller had developed a voicing technique, namely the integration of a particular section, how harmonically they relate to each other. And the uniqueness of the Miller sound was the saxophone section, where the tenor saxophone and the clarinet were voiced. They literally played the same notes, one, the clarinet, simply an octave above the other. And it gave a particular, if not unique, brilliance which came to be known as the Miller Sound.
I get it, yeah.
And he wrote a number of tunes, one of them becoming his now legendary Moonlight Serenade, and you would hear this magnificent voicing technique that was so effective. But again, the Miller Band was primarily a dance band.
Yeah, that is rich. Thank you. You've helped me understand perfectly now. Something I'd always wondered about was what accounted for this distinctive Miller sound. Thanks to you also, Bob, we've got Moonlight Serenade here, so want to listen to it?
Yes, I think it's on tape, and the quality may not be the best, but what's sort of interesting is that this is a live air shot, as they called it, a remote, that occurred at a place called the Glen Island Casino in the openings of their season, their musical season, in 1939. And you will hear the crowd noise first, and then Hugh James, the announcer, coming in to announce where they are in this new band, the Glenn Miller Band, and then you'll hear that great theme of Glenn's Moonlight Serenade.
This is going to be like eavesdropping on 1939. Fantastic. Let's hear it.
Mid spotlights and celebrities, the Glen Island Casino opens its 1939 season. Let's listen to Glenn Miller's music. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight there comes music from beside the waters of Long Island Sound. NBC's microphones are present at Glenn Miller's smart opening in the Glen Island Casino, mecca of music for moderns, just off the Shore Road at New Rochelle, New York. Now may we proffer our invitation to dance to the music of one of America's foremost swing trombonists and ace arrangers, Glenn Miller and his orchestra.
Bob, let me ask you this, which I guess is the most logical question at this point about the big band era. When does it end?
For all practical purposes, the big band era ended in about 1946. In December of 46, my friend George Simon records at no less than 8 big bands disbanded. In other words, here we are about a year, year and a half after World War II ends. Abortive attempts had been made to continue the big band era, but for a variety of reasons, it just didn't happen. And the era basically ended at the end of 46. And really, it was a little less than 12 years since Benny Goodman hit the big band big time with his band in late 34 and 35. And it was all over by December of 46.
What accounts for that? I mean, what breaks it up?
Well, there are basically, as I see it, there are three major problems which collectively brought the big band scene to a close. First, the effects of the World War II itself. First, during the war, there was a sharp reduction in the number of talented players. Most of them were in the service. Second, there was a gas shortage. Trips to dance halls and to hotels were simply made increasingly difficult. And thirdly, the government imposed a very stiff 20% amusement tax at that time.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, that amusement tax remains, to the best of my knowledge, it has never come off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's first. The first item was the effects of the war itself.
Yeah.
Secondly, there was an absolutely disastrous recording strike in 1942. The union boss, a gentleman by the name of Cesar Petrillo, with his concerns about recorded music supplanting live music, You recall mm-hmm. the so-called jukebox era?
I certainly even recall Cesar Petrillo.
Well, there was a disastrous strike, as George Simon points out. The bands didn't want it. The recording companies didn't want it. But it happened.
Yeah.
The result was that it was not permitted that ASCOP, that is, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, no ASCAP music could be played by bands. The only thing they could play was something in the public domain, mm-hmm. such as Genie with a Light Brown Hair.
Let me ask you this, Bob, as we conclude our look at the big band era of jazz history. What's its meaning? I mean, as a musician, looking back on it, what did it contribute? What's left? What did it give us?
Well, let me take a step back, because I am convinced that if Bach and Mozart were alive today, they would be some of the great swinging jazz guys around. So that, as far as I'm concerned, jazz in all forms is another form of serious music. It's simply that some people have that big bad disease, they don't know they don't know. So the point is, it, in my judgment, has left a lasting impact that's never going to be the same. Mm-hmm. That is, music will never be the same.
Bob, that's a terrific answer. Thank you so much for being with us today on Dialogue. We're going to continue our look into jazz in our next conversation. Thank
Delighted
you.
Delighted to be here.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Dr. Robert Litwack, jazz musician and cardiothoracic surgeon. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our production engineer is Anthony Barber. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. You can also listen to Dialogue on the web at wilsoncenter.org/dialogue. Email us on America Online at radiodial@aol.com. That's RADIODIAL@AOL.com.